aquí a este país con mis padres en el año 74, enero 18 del 74. Llegué a las 10 de la mañana y a las 12 de la noche comencé a trabajar en mi primer trabajo. Wow. El mismo día que llegué.
Okay. ¿Cuántos años tenías?
Tenía 18 años. 17 para cumplir 18, no tenía 18 cumplido todavía. Bueno.
Something tells me that this sentence is in exactly the same order, has been repeated many times before. This is how Ramona de la Cruz begins telling the story of her arrival to the United States. I came to this country with my parents in January 18, 1974. I arrived at 10 a.m. and the same day and night, I began working in my first job. I was 17 years old.
De ahí me trabajaba de noche y...
After a few months, she left that job to go back to school. She completed 10th grade, but when her father got sick, she left school and went back to work. Later, she obtained her GED. Since then, she has been working very hard. Hi, my name is Gloria Lopez Enriquez, and I'm a family therapist. Ramona de la Cruz and her daughter Jocelyn, now an adult, will be talking with us about their experiences during Jocelyn's adolescence. Some consider the teen years problematic and, in the case of Latinas, dangerous. For years, the Center of Disease Control and Prevention have reported that Latinas exhibit high levels of depression, suicidal ideations, and attempts. Many researchers and clinicians believe that the Latino culture and the mother-daughter relationship some of the key factors beyond these statistics. This is what Dr. Gill, president and CEO of Human Life and founder of Life is Precious, a suicidal prevention program for Latinas, have to say during an interview in the Manhattan Neighborhood Network in regard to the high levels of depression, suicidal ideation and attempts among Latinas.
Well, you know, there are several factors, Taina. One of that is the issue of immigration. We are a young community, in a way, in the country and here. We have immigrated. Some of the youth, especially Latina adolescents, or either they were born in another country and they have come and settled here, or they have been born here but their parents are from one of the Latin American countries, Caribbean countries. And immigration, by the way, I should say that when we look at the data, the scientific data for Central, South, and the Caribbean area, there's no high incidence of suicide among their adolescents in those countries. So if they're coming from those countries and that's not a problem there, then one have to raise the question, what is causing this? And the researchers and us practitioners, we believe that immigration is an intervening variable here, because what happened to all of us is that we have to go then through the process of acculturation. And acculturation means that you have to begin to learn to adapt to a different culture that has different ways of values, different ways of behaving. And the adolescents and the youth find themselves between two worlds. The parents, their mothers, they acculturate much less and at a lower rate. And the adolescents, because they go to school and it's faster, they become more attuned to the American values and the behaviors of their peers. So what happened in the home is that the youth, the Latino youth, want to imitate their peers. In the case of the girls, you know, they want to go out with boyfriends and stay late. And the mother said, hey, wait a minute now. You know, when I was growing up in Dominican Republic or El Salvador, we didn't do that. So then there are beginning clashes around autonomy and independence. And I should say that the American society, the values of this culture is toward more independence and autonomy. While our culture, you know, a girl's supposed to be more dependent, less independent, depending on the family and the parents. So there's a clash here about what is acceptable, what is the belief system.
This interview with Ramona, an immigrant mother, and Jess Lee, her U.S.-born daughter, transpired radically different perspectives than those presented not only by Dr. Gill, but by many researchers, clinicians, and the media. From a phenomenological perspective, the important reality is what this mother and daughter perceive to be their real role. I conducted the interview mostly in Spanish to guarantee the mother's full participation. I interviewed them in their home, their family world.
Entró a los Beggin a primer grado con una profesora que llamaba Mrs. Trotía. Entonces, Mrs. Trotía
Jessamy went to first grade in North Bergen. The teacher, Miss Trotía, a name that Ramona will never forget, called her one day to let her know that her daughter was a very smart girl and that based on her academic progress, she should be in the honor roll. Miss Trotía, however, didn't want to put Giselle's name on such a list, afraid of the reactions from other parents and teachers in a mostly white school. It was a way to protect her, she said. She told Ramona that as her teacher, she will continue to support her daughter's academic program. As Ramona explains, that experience taught her that those things happen, but she didn't give too much attention to the incident. She was young and inexperienced. Also, the number of Latinos in her community at that time was a lot smaller. She felt it was no much. At the beginning of this podcast, Ramona begins her story describing how she left school after completing 10th grade because her father became. It is not by accident that most of her story revolves around schooling and education. Not only her, but her entire family deeply believe in education as a ticket out of poverty. This is a belief that has been inculcated in each and every child and young person in the extended family, and it has been fruitful. Jessely and many of her cousins are college graduates. But let's go back to the story. Jessely did extremely well in elementary, middle school, and high school. She was not only a superb student, but very talented in music and involved in all kinds of school-related activities. It was difficult for her mother and father to follow Jessely's busy schedule, but in the middle of their work and other commitments, they did. Regarding her social life, Ramona and Jocelyn agreed that Ramona was very comfortable with the idea that two of Jocelyn's closest friends were Americans, meaning white. For Ramona, it was important that her daughter socialize with other teens who were not Latinos. Ramona believes that learning the culture of this country is helpful to her daughter. During Jessely's teen years, she encouraged her to be an American and behave like such. When I asked Ramona how she identifies herself, she stated that she identifies as an American from Dominican Republic. With some hesitation, she says, American, but I am an American.
Yeah.
Americana,
pero yo soy americana.
For Jessely, the business of her identity seems to be more complicated. Although she was born in this country, she identifies herself as a Latina, Dominican American, in that order.
I was born here, but in this area, everybody's pretty much Hispanic. You know, you're from Colombia, if you're from, I mean, And I knew when I, those instances that she was talking about, when, like, I, you know, when I was in North Bergen and stuff like that, like, I knew that there were differences. Like, I knew I was, how do you say it? Like, I knew I was American, but that I wasn't. At the same time, right? Because she, to them, like, I'm American because I'm born here and I'm not Dominican. But you know that you're not the same. So I wanted to go away and see what that was. And that's how, so I want, like, that's, so it's like I wanted to go away to see what that was. And it was very hard.
Tell me a little more about
that. Well, because at home, you know, I mean, I spoke Spanish. All my friends were Hispanic. Like, I actually didn't, like, I did have two friends in high school that they were actually the only friends who weren't from another country. That they were the only friends I had actually in high school that identified themselves as white. You know, so, and they were the two friends that she's talking about. So I actually, in high school, had my two closest friends were white. They were the whitest people in the school. You know what I mean? And we were really good friends, but there was always a difference. You know what I mean? And I was very close with them and stuff like that. But I even knew, like their mother would say, you know, would get really mad when she would think, like, oh, you know, are you dating those Hispanic boys? Or, like, I would hear them. They would come to me and say, my mom doesn't want me to date, you know, because we were high school, we were friends. So they would be like, I'm so upset. My mom doesn't want me to date this boy because he's, you know, whatever. It's like saying he's black or whatever. And I was like, oh, man, you know, whatever. And it's crazy because I go to her house and I sleep over and they give me clothes and she's my friend's mom. So it was very, like, weird, like, different, you know what I mean? Like, I knew that. I don't know how to explain that. I knew I was different. Like, you see on TV, like, you don't see anybody who's Hispanic. You don't see anybody that looks like you, has your story. Like, you just know you're different.
High school was a challenge for Ramona and her daughter. For Jocelyn, the discriminatory experience she had in first grade were repeated again as she entered high school. Because of her high academic standing in middle school, she was ready to take honor classes in math and science in ninth grade. The high school gave her a hard time accepting her in advanced classes. This time, her parents bought the school, and she found herself again attending honor classes, where she was the only Latina student. For Ramona, in addition to her occasional willfulness, Jocelyn became a lot more independent in high school. Independence was something that she had intentionally cultivated in her daughter since she was a little girl. But at times, the degree of independence that Jocelyn assumed was worrisome to her. Jocelyn, in the opinion of her mother, is headstrong and at times very difficult to protect. As explained by Jocelyn, her determination and independence are also functions of having parents from another country.
I mean, just the whole experience of having to, like, translate.
Para él,
you know, not for anything, like, son diferente, just translate. Like, for example, you gave us the consent form, okay, and you read it for her. You know, like, and that's not in Spanish, you know, so it's like there's experiences that I have that other kids don't have. They don't have to, you know, explain, well, what this is and this is.
Yeah.
You know, and so at the same time, it's very hard, right, like, for her to have authority over me like a parent, when at the same time she, you know, I'm a buffer in a way, you know, like
in other things,
you know what I mean, like, I have, you know, because I speak the language, because I'm born here and this is another country, like, we are outsiders in another country, so it's like I'm the one with the skills from this country, so I negotiated those, we all did, like, it wasn't just me, you know, like, all my cousins we do this, you know, like, I'm not the only one who does this. Like, you know, it's not. Maybe that was also part of, like, why she says I'm so headstrong.
Es otra cosa.
Because it's also, like, I had to, you know, I learned to be also a little bit of, I have a little bit of authority. So it's got a hard to reel you back in.
Yes.
Right? It's very hard to be like, you need to do what I say because I'm the boss when I have more, when I have a lot more responsibility than I should at my age, I guess should, or what, you know what I mean? When we rely on each other for stuff. So it's like, oh, I, you know, so I think that's part of it too. You know, when I have to make the phone call or I have to translate this or explain this and do that. And that's not just me. That's every child who has a parent who's from another country.
Yes.
They come here and, you know, they go straight to work. Mm-hmm. They're not, you know, they learn as much English as they need to, but the complicated stuff, it has to be negotiated by someone. So that's mm-hmm. me or my brother or...
Mm-hmm. So there's a contradiction between how protective your parents can be of you as parents, but at the same time, because of what is going on and because they come from different realities, your parents and you, sometimes you're the one who's, you know, the authority.
Yeah,
so sometimes so they can protect you and they can be so. But in other places, you're the authority.
Yeah.
You're the one who has the authority.
Like I know, places. Like I've been to places with my mom where I'm like, you know, I know that they don't understand what people are saying. And I've been in situations where I've heard them and I'll be like, I know what you're saying.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I know what you're saying about me. I already know the look on your face. Mm-hmm. You know, so I'm also very... It's funny because she's protective of me, but I'm protective of them.
Yeah.
So it's like don't be messing with my parents.
It's like a equal relationship in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? Because I understand, like in certain... We've been in places where I understand things and they don't. Right? Mm-hmm. And my dad knows more English, but mm-hmm. you know... So I'm very protective of that, you know, like, or if my mom speaks with an accent, when she does speak English, because she speaks English very well.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, but when she practices it more, so I'm very, like, sensitive to that.
Many believe that the complexity of becoming oneself or the so-called identity crisis may be multiplied for an adolescent when two or more cultural orientations are involved. That may be the case, and it could have been the case for Jessalyn. She experienced some depressions during her adolescence.
One time in high school, I was in my senior year, and, you know, I was a student, whatever. I had teenager testing limits, and I was late for class, and you're supposed to go to detention at the end of the day, and I didn't go. I said, let's see what happens. Let's see what happens. The next day, I came into school, and they brought me in for in-school suspension. Now, I've never been suspended. This is like a teenager testing limits.
Mm-hmm.
So I go to in-school suspension, and they tell you to write why, what you did to get here, to get into in-school
mm-hmm.
suspension,
mm-hmm.
and what is... You know, something like, what is your responsibility to kind of whatever? So, I mean, me. And I decided to write. I wrote that I am an in-school suspension because I was late for school yesterday. And I didn't go to detention. That's it. But it was a shaming tactic, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because kids who went to in-school were, you know, problematic kids. but I was there and I wrote that. And then, you know, I was sitting. They brought me my homework and I was done with it half the day. So then, you know, I started writing about what I did and didn't like about the school.
Mm-hmm.
So I wrote that I was in love with music classes and I liked this and like that. And otherwise, I didn't have a reason at that. And I wrote something like, I was angry. I was like, I can't wait for this to end. That I can't wait for high school for this, but I wrote for this to end.
Mm-hmm.
And they brought me in,
mm-hmm.
and they had my essay
mm-hmm.
highlighted in all red
mm-hmm.
to screen me for suicide if I wanted to kill myself.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, what? And they were like, do you want to die?
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, no, I don't want to die. I'm just saying that I'm done with high school and this.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? I mean, at the same time, I was late because I was working the night before, and, you know, it was annoying to me. I was a teenager. But, you know, I was like, wow, that's weird. And so they sent me, like, to get screened and everything like that because they were scared that I was going to kill myself,
mm-hmm.
that I wanted to die.
Yeah. Was it, were people in the school worried that you were kind of unhappy?
No, it was only because I had written that.
Oh, it was only because...
Because I had written that. Otherwise,
they didn't know.
They didn't know...
That you were struggling with, you know, sadness and things like that.
No, they never... Sometimes some teachers would, like, pull me aside and be like,
mm-hmm.
Jessalyn...
Mm-hmm.
You know, I noticed that you're not doing everything
like before.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I had some teachers in high school sometimes pull me aside and kind of be like, you're not really performing like
mm-hmm.
you usually do, what's going on and
mm-hmm.
stuff like that. And I'd be like, everything's fine and this and that, and it's fine. I would lie.
Mm-hmm.
that I was fine. Mm-hmm. It could have been I was going through something or whatever, but, you know, and then when I would get better, I would perform better. Mm-hmm. Like, I never got so bad in my grades that I would allow people to see that there was something really wrong at the same time, if there was something really wrong. Mm-hmm. I mean, because to me, school was so important, and
so that
it was also a way out, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It kept you going.
Yes.
Doing well in school.
Doing well in school was something that I...
Important.
That was important.
Yeah.
But sometimes, yeah, I would like, become a little too much.
Yeah. What was too much? What make you sad?
When I was younger?
Yeah.
It was a lot of... You know, you're a teenager, you're going through stuff, mm-hmm. and it's just like... I don't know, like, when you're a teenager, everything is the end of the world.
Yeah. You feel very intensively.
Yeah, you feel very intensively, and you're also, like, aware, you know what I mean? Like, naturally, teenagers are, like, aware of what's going on.
Mm-hmm. So to know the reality of the world?
Yeah, and to know, be aware of what's going on, and then to have to kind of, like, still kind of live within your role. Even though you know what's going on, you know, you have limitations as a teenager. You have the insight of more or less like kind of an adult, but you have the limitations of being a teenager.
Yeah.
You know, so you do have to, you know, so like I probably as I got older, you know, I'll tell you honestly, I stopped asking my mom to sign permission slips in sixth grade. I started signing permission slips myself. I decided when I was going on a field trip, when I wanted to go, how I wanted to go from day one. I stopped that very early. I'm like, oh, I'm going to
do this. And she invited me.
I would decide. I would say, you know what, I don't want to go on that field trip, so I'm going to tell them that my mom didn't sign it.
Okay.
And that's it.
Yeah.
I was very, and, you know, I would, you know, at that point, you're an adult. I mean, like, in my position,
You had a lot of responsibilities.
I already had been doing, you know, where things go home, people go home and they ask their parents for things. There were things... I kind of knew what I needed and not needed to ask my parents for because what was the point?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've been making this decision a long time already.
Yeah.
Because you stop negotiating at some point in time and you just take it on. So it's like high school, I just kind of took it on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I would tell her I was doing this and that and this and that. But at that point, you're kind of just like figuring it out for yourself.
Hmm. Did you feel that at any point that you had too many responsibilities?
Yeah, I guess. No, not until recently.
Mm.
Not until recently. Because I also thought, like, it was good. I mean, I saw my parents be responsible, you know, like...
Mm-hmm. They were.
So I saw them be responsible, so I just thought that that's what you
do. That's the way it is.
That's the way it is.
Okay.
You know, like, and, you know, they had to wake up and go to work at 8 o'clock every day. My dad even earlier. So my mom would wake us up and kind of be like, you guys got to get up and get ready to go to school.
Mm-hmm.
So we knew, like, at the same time that they were going to work, they were doing. We needed to do too.
Yeah.
So.
Okay. But now you see it differently? I'm just so
beautiful. Well, now it's like, oh, yeah, that's right. People tell you, like, oh, wow, just leave like that. And I'm like, oh, yeah, I guess so.
Yeah,
but
in the middle of it, you couldn't see it, but now, like,
and, you know.
Yeah, it was a lot.
That was a lot at the time. Yeah, and yeah.
When I asked Ramona if she ever thought her daughter was depressed, she immediately answered, oh, yes, many times. She asked Jessely about it, but she denied it. Ramona, not satisfied with his answer, found ways to detect when Jessely was feeling down. She began to pay attention to the kinds of books Jessely was reading. When they were dark in content, she knew her daughter was depressed. Jessely heard for the first time about her mom's creative attempts to reach out to her during this interview.
It's so weird that she said that. In high school, I used to read Sylvia Plath a lot.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
The Bell Jar.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
I read a lot of Sylvia Plath in high school. I loved Sylvia Plath, but you know she killed herself.
Uh-huh.
She committed suicide.
Uh-huh.
Así, yo...
Entonces tu mami estaba correcta.
Yes, sí. But you know I was reading.
Ella no estaba en todo eso, creo.
I'm surprised that she knows that because she's right. I was reading like Sylvia Plath.
Yeah.
I was reading Virginia Woolf. I was reading books by the
Dad que yo go to the side, torture like that.
Sí,
touching books, eh?
Very dark.
And actually, that's what attracted me to Sylvia Plath was that I read a poem or something in class once in English class, and somebody, you know, and then they gave us the history how she had killed herself and this and that, and I was like, wow, like, and she wrote this deep stuff, like. Mm. Out of her sadness, so I went and I would get her books from the library. Right. I read the Belcher and stuff like that. Like, and I always think about, wow, she was writing about how sad she was.
In the middle of these emotional times, Gisli was making very important decisions about her future. She wanted to study music, something her mother thought wasn't for her because they were poor. In Ramona's opinion, Gisli needed to study something productive, something that would support her financially. However, Gisli went to study music in Albany. A second decision, where she and her mother were not in agreement, was about rejecting an offer from her high school to apply to Princeton University. Her mother didn't understand her daughter's decision, but Gisli had very good reasons.
Here's the thing, my mom, we're dealing in two different worlds.
Okay.
We're dealing in what was my reality and what my mom understood was my reality.
Que yo me imagino que ella quiere, que quiero para ella.
Okay. Yeah.
Ella quiere siempre lo mejor.
So it's dos niveles diferentes.
Yeah. Okay. I did not ever even apply to go to any of those schools. Mm-hmm. When I applied to college, I just applied to a couple of schools and was like, I'll figure this out. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, as I go. Because, you know, when you're 18, 17 years old, you're making decisions on your own.
Mm-hmm.
That determine the trajectory. Mm-hmm. But I knew, like, when we were applying for financial aid and stuff like that, what I could and couldn't do. You know what I mean? So it was a process that I had, that me and my brother, like, you know, we navigated on our own. You know, because not for nothing, like, my parents came here, and she told you, she came here at 10 o'clock, and that evening she was working.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like my mom had applied to college.
Mm-hmm.
She had not gone to an American, you know. We were figuring that out on our own,
mm-hmm.
based on what we were learning at home, how we had to be here.
Yes.
You know, it's...
So how was that...
Cuando ella fue,
what decision for you to make? Because it was you making the decision about not going to Princeton.
Yeah.
How was that? How was that for you? When they said, yeah, we're going to prepare you and you will go to Princeton.
Yeah.
And your mom was like, well, yes, Princeton. And then you have to start thinking how that's going
to be. No reality. I mean...
that was hard. It was hard to face that reality. You would like, you know, something like
that. Yeah, I mean, it was very hard. Like, I think I have had a lot of potential, but it's been dimmed, you know what I mean? Because we had other responsibilities, you know what I mean? Like, so I'm used to making sacrifices.
Okay.
That's not new. And the whole point is the end game for me. Mm-hmm. Has always been, you know, like, what you have to... I don't know, for me it was just like, you have to make things work for what you have, like, what you have to work with, realistically, you have to make things work. That's what my mom taught me. I mean, that's what I learned from them, that it wasn't about, you know, the label or anything like how it looked, that it was at the end, like, whatever you made it.
Yeah.
Like, however you decided to produce that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, I just kind of was finding myself at the same time, like, you know, trying to figure that out.
It was hard for Gisli. I could hear in her voice and saw it in the tears she didn't want us to see. Ramona knew that too, and wished she could take the pain away from her daughter, but she knew she couldn't. Gisli thought about it for a while and quickly connected her having been alone finding her way in her late teen years with her parents finding their way in the world at exactly the same age.
So I think to myself too, you know, not for nothing, I'm out here doing this by myself, but she did it too by herself.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, she had her family. Mm-hmm. My mother had her family and stuff like that. Pero mi padre vinieron aquí a este país, ¿sabes? a los 17, 18 años, I was trying to figure out why, how to do this whole American dream, you go to college thing, and...
A la misma edad.
A la misma edad que ellos están en este país tratando de lidiar lo que es en este país y trabajar.
At the end, Giselle believes that her parents, her own, the rest of her family members' sacrifices are paying off. She knows well the reasons her parents immigrated to this country and that this adventure required a great deal from everybody. She believes that compared to what her parents have done, her share has been small.
My parents did not come to this country for me not to embrace every opportunity that this country has. You know what I mean? That we can do here. Like, that I've never lost sight of, ever. That I feel like I was indoctrinated that. Like, we came here for you to have opportunity, because where we came from, there was no food. Mm-hmm. They didn't, you know, there was less food. There was less access to food. There were food insecurities, clothing insecurities. Like, I know, like, I would get so mad when I was little that, like, my favorite toys and clothes would go missing, because they were sending them back to DR, and I was like, what the hell? I like that dress. I would get so mad, but my mom would always be, and I would get pictures of, like, my cousins, and they'd be wearing my dress, and I'd be like, oh, why is she wearing my dress? That's my dress.
When ending our interview, Ramona told us a bittersweet story. When Jesselyn was about 4 years old, she had a collection of 157 Barbies. One day, Ramona took all her dolls, put them in a suitcase, and sent them to Dominican Republic. Jesselyn was furious. Now as an adult, she laughs about the incident, but she remembers, well, it was not funny at all when that happened.